Perhaps Peter Grimes feared the same fate.
Soon the fatal hour arrived that Captain Rogers had to die to satisfy offended justice and hangs on yonder gallows high.
Songs like this and The Captain's Apprentice record the anger and express the anguish which Benjamin Britten further developed in his opera Peter Grimes. Their strength of word and tune and emotional depth engage folk singers and their audiences to this day.
So come you captains all throughout this nation, hear voice and warning, take by me, take special care of your apprentice when you were on the raging sea.
Jim Murray's recent version of the song, collected by Vaughan Williams in 1905, ending The Captain's Apprentice, presented by Roy Palmer. The reader was Joe Sims and the producer, Julian May. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second part of tonight's prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the BBC proms. Musically, we're in a storm-tossed Aldborough for a performance of English National Opera's production of Britten's Peter Grimes, conducted by the company's music director, Edward Gardner. When people talk about Grimes, one opera that's often seen as a model is Berg's Wozzeck. They have an anti-hero in common for whom their composers express anger and compassion, indicting society around them. And Britten admired Berg greatly. Another prototype, which like Wozzeck makes organic use of orchestral interludes, is Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk district, which Britten had heard in a BBC Symphony Orchestra performance in the late 30s. One can imagine the impact that opera's orchestral palette had on him. Nonetheless, the score of Britten's first full-scale opera seems to have appeared a fully formed masterpiece out of nowhere. I asked Edward Gardner during rehearsal this morning where he thought it came from.
The time of the century, Second World War and the end of it. Berg, who was obsessed with Wozzeck at that time, and I think you certainly hear a lot of that. But there's something so raw and young and risk-taking. It doesn't have the finesse and perfection of later pieces, but my God, I prefer it to almost anything else he wrote. This was unashamedly a number opera, and it's wonderful for that. The quartet, you know, Ellen's aria, Grimes's arias, it rejoices in that, and I think it's a much stronger piece because of it. And because of that, Britten can look a little bit at music theatre. He can look a little bit at madrigals, I think, at the beginning of the great ensemble of Act Two. He can look at, you know, more chambery string pieces in a British tradition. And I love that rich tapestry. It just hits you so hard. I mean, what this must have sounded like in 1945, I have absolutely no idea, because I can tell you, standing in front of it now, the impact of the music, not just the loud stuff, the beautiful quartet or the Great Bear, you know, sung by Stuart Skelton so wonderfully. It's enormous. There's nothing like it in his output, I think.
Ed Gardner. Well, Act Two of Peter Grimes begins with an orchestral interlude which paints a fine Sunday morning with sunlight glinting on the waves and church bells ringing. Ellen appears with Grimes' new apprentice, John. As the church service begins in the background, Ellen notices a tear in the boy's coat and a bruise on his neck. As she ponders their significance, Grimes appears to collect the boy. He's seen a shoal of fish and wants to put to sea. Ellen pleads with Peter to let John have a day off. She can't see the point of all this work. Grimes retorts that it'll buy him and Ellen a home, respect and freedom. She mentions the bruise, questioning whether it was a mistake to plan a new start, then despairingly tells him they've failed. They quarrel, and Peter hits out at Ellen before dragging the boy away. They've been witnesses to the scene, and as the congregation leaves the church, Bowles stirs up their anger. Grimes is at his exercise, he says. Ellen tries to explain her compassion, but the crowd shouts her down. The rector suggests the men should visit Grimes in his hut, and Hobson is fetched to lead them with his drum. Only Auntie, the nieces and Ellen remain and sing of the unequal relationship of men with women. The orchestral interlude expresses Grimes' divided nature, his loneliness, his turbulent spirit and his vision, something which further alienates the people around him. The second scene of Act Two is set in Grimes' hut at the top of a cliff. He arrives in a towering rage and orders the boy to get things together, to go to sea. His bullying frightens John, and Grimes tries to be kind to him. He thinks of the life he'd planned with Ellen, then imagines he can see his dead former apprentice staring up at him. He hears the drum of the rector's procession approaching the hut. He blames the boy and Ellen for gossiping and decides to make a quick getaway through the back door to the cliff. He tells the boy to climb down, and as he goes to follow, Grimes hears a knock at the main door which stops him in his tracks. That moment, the boy screams as he loses his footing and falls. The distraught Grimes climbs after him. The mob come into the hut, find nobody there, and leave. Only Bulstrode remains, looking round, perhaps imagining the worst. So here once again comes tonight's conductor, Edward Gardner, joining Chorus and Orchestra of English National Opera on stage here in the Albert Hall to begin Act Two of Britain's Peter Grimes.
Thank you. was I done before you came? Badly torn. That was done recently. Take your hand away. Your neck, is it? John, what are you trying to do?
Peter. This I us respect and buy us freedom from pain of grinning at gossip's tales. Believe me, we shall be free.
Father, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived.
Peter, tell me one thing.
Thank you. Oh! your sea boots. Take the bright and fancy buckles off your feet. There's Royalston and Sou'wester. Stir your pins, we must get ready. These barter gossips listen to money, only to money. Efficiency dry, flood the market. Now is our chance to get a good catch. Get money to choke them in my throat. I'm sent out with house and home and shop. I'll marry Ellen. I'll marry Ellen.
Thank you. here in this heart.
He's there now. I can see him. He's there.
His eyes are on me as they were that evil day.
Stop moaning, boy! Water! There is no more water. You had the last yesterday. You'll soon be home.
In harbor still and deep. There's an odd procession here. Parson and Swallow coming near. Wait! You've been talking, you and that little gossiping. What lies have you been telling? The bar is climbing up the hill to get me, me! Oh, I'm not scared. I'll send them off with a flea in their ear. I'll show them, I'll show them. I know. Watching me with an idiot's drooling gaze.
How deep?
Say 40 feet.
Dangerous to leave the door open.
He used to keep his boat down there. Maybe they've both gone fishing.
Yet his hut is reasonably kept. He has order. He is
the whole affair is but a rubber talk. It's, shall I say, quietus. Here we come, pell-mell, expecting to find out. We know not what, but all we find is a neat and empty heart. Gentlemen, take this to your wives. Less interference in our private lives.
Quite certainly it's staying here. And will the last to go please close the door?
Thank you.
deadly, eerie end to that act. And in the stage performances at the London Coliseum, in David Alden's production, Peter Grimes cradles the dead apprentice down on the shore, while up in Grimes' hut, Bulstrode muses on what might have happened. The end of Act Two of Benjamin Britten's opera in this BBC Proms performance of the English National Opera production. Chorus and Orchestra V&O, conducted by Edward Gardner. We are getting a flavour of the staging, I have to say. There's the odd prop, the odd hat, and quite a lot of movement up and down the cliffs and in and out of church. Don't forget there's a programme with full text on the BBC Proms website. Well, for the next 20 minutes during the interval before Act 3 of Peter Grimes here in the Albert Hall, award-winning sports writer, nature writer, bird watcher and resident of East Anglia, Simon Barnes, contemplates the influence of the Suffolk soundscape he knows so well on the music of Benjamin Britten.
Peter Grimes is a universal tale, and it could happen anywhere. So I've been told anyway, any culture could bring us a story about a community united as never before by the hatred of an individual within it. You could set it in the Inca Empire, in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, in Soweto, in the Australian outback, in the East End of London or Coronation Street, and it would work perfectly. So long as you didn't listen to the music. There's a story, I can't vouch for its truth, about Sir John Gielgud directing an opera. In the stresses of rehearsal, he shouted desperately, "Stop, stop, stop that dreadful music!" But if you don't stop Benjamin Britten's music, and if you know Suffolk with your eyes closed, you realise that Peter Grimes couldn't live anywhere else. The natural music of the mad and volatile Suffolk coast is echoed again and again in the composed music of the opera. It's at its clearest in the Four Sea Interludes. Not much Peruvian rainforest or Australian desert there. You can hear it in unquantifiable ways, an evocation in sound of the big-skied, shingle-shifting coast with its waving reed beds rising up, but not very much, to the sandling heathland behind it. And you can hear it precisely and measurably in the sounds of the birds. In the dawn piece, I can hear the cries of waders, redshank and curlew, not pedantically transcribed, but unmistakable. In the moonlight piece, there are sharp alarm calls to be heard. Waders are often active at night, being more driven by the rhythms of the tides than the sun. Alarm calls are often common to more than one species. A warning of danger is a useful message for birds other than your conspecifics. These brief cries are a kind of Esperanto, language available to all. The Sunday morning piece is full of reed warbler, the rhythms and variations bouncing along merrily as the people of the borough set about their Sabbath duties. It's Suffolk, all right. Alborough, to be more precise. And there are times when I rather resent the fierce and terrible drama that goes around these interludes. If I were out in the borough, I'd want to walk away from all the human troubles and lose myself once again in the beauties and wonders of the soundscape of Suffolk. It's not a place like anywhere else. By Suffolk, I mean East Suffolk. And by East Suffolk, I mean the coastal strip. You can't understand this without coming to terms with the A12. This is the coast road, brief chunks of dual carriageway broken up by 30-mile-an-hour crawls through villages, slow, dramatic bends to embarrass the weekending townie, and the occasional verge-to-verge tractor. But the thing about this coast road is that it's nowhere near the coast. It's just as close as they dare. You know developers. They'd love to build a highway that links up the coastal towns of Aldborough with Dunwich and Walberswick, across the Blythe to Southwold, and then southward to Orford and Felixstowe. But it can't be done. As you get towards the sea, Suffolk goes all squishy and squashy and crumbly and soft, and it simply can't be trusted. I was brought up on Cornish seaside holidays. Out there you get land, ta-da! And then you get sea with an equally emphatic ta-da. You know where you are. You're either on a cliff that beetles all his base into the sea, or you're in the heaving Atlantic, vast, uncompromising chunks of land, forever menaced by equally uncompromising waves. But it's not like that in Suffolk. Sure, there's land. And then again, there's sea. But in between, there's a great load of stuff that can't really make up its mind. It's shifty, volatile, impermanent, neither one thing nor the other. Left to itself, it would be losing reed beds and creating new ones, building shingle ridges by the process called longshore drift, an action performed at a speed that mocks geology, while the river estuaries change their shape by the season, all in a cycle of destruction and renewal. Behind them lies the Sandling Heath, former seedbed, lifted up by the unfathomable workings of geology and hydrology and time, to become dry, scrubby, well-grazed places studded with pine and gorse. The sky is huge, but the land is not flat, not in the Lincolnshire or Fenland sense, where you can walk all day without losing sight of your car. Suffolk undulates. A little quirkily, it's true, but it has a rhythm of its own, and it sticks to it, more or less, anyway. So, listen. On the shore, the little waves of the North Sea tease the shingle, but that's not a sound that carries so very far. Walk inland a few paces, leave the shingle behind, and enter into the marshes. Those reed beds, they're the real thing. They have a sound of their own. There's even a word for this sound. The wind passes through the seed heads. The sound is soughing, or soughing, if you prefer. The OED allows both pronunciations. The latter is more onomatopoeic. Drop your head down below the level of these soughing seed heads. Enter a different world. There's a suite of creatures here that have their being in the reeds. And this is not a place where you can see very far, so sound matters. I remember one May dawn when I took my old friend Bob Schoenstedt, ornithologist and master of African birdsong, down to the Warberswick marshes. There we had one of the great concerts, a double concerto for nightingale and bittern. Behind us on the heath, the bird almost sitting on our shoulders, the nightingale was letting rip with his incomparable virtuosity, mixing sweet melody with the most challenging of modernist passages. Before us in the reeds, the bird almost at our feet, the bittern gave us that far-carrying bass line, a great humming didgeridoo grunt. Bitterns are reedbed specialists. One of the great conservation triumphs of the last couple of decades has been to manage reedbeds in a way that bitterns like them best. So there are now many more bitterns around than when Britain, nice anagram, wrote Peter Grimes during the Second World War. We stood in silence for an hour and more, Bob holding up a giant parabolic reflector plus omnidirectional mic to record every nuance. The sounds of the Suffolk coast gently printed themselves onto the tape, for it was still tape in those days. A symphony, a sea interlude, a marsh and heath interlude, and Bob's recording was no whit worse than anything you are listening to tonight. A human hand, a human intention, is not essential for even the greatest music. May is the best time, of course, when the migrants have flown in and all the birds sing out, and like most musicians, their main subjects are life and sex and love and hope. In the reed beds, you hear the songs of reed warbler and sedge warbler. The reed warbler rhythmic and structured, the sedge more rambling and inventive. In a good year for sedge warblers, their necessary proximity in the reeds inspires them to reach for new heights of creativity as they try to outdo each other. Birdsong is the way a male establishes a territory, repels male rivals, and attracts a female. Broadly speaking, birdsong comes in two types: the stereotypical singers who repeat the same chunk again and again, and the repertoire singers who go in for variations. It has been established that the greater your repertoire, the sexier you are. In other words, biology encourages creativity. But birdsong is more beautiful than it needs to be. Why is that? Because the females demand it. The only possible answer, one that goes back to Darwin and his discussion of sexual selection in The Origin of Species, published in 1859. It is said that the sedge warbler never sings exactly the same song twice in his life. Behind these songs, you can hear the monosyllabic comments of reed bunting, a poor song, it has to be said, but it is his own and no one else's. At any time of year, you can hear the pingers, as birders call them, uttering a sound that's usually compared to an old-fashioned cash register. They are more formally known as bearded tits, probably because they're not actually tits and they don't have beards. Very dashing and dapper they look too, with their orange feathers and their cad's moustaches. The soundscape of Suffolk has changed since Britain wrote the opera, and has changed too since Peter Grimes suffered his torments, or to be less fanciful, since George Crabbe wrote The Borough, the poem on which Britain based the opera, in the first decade of the 19th century. For a start, you'll now often hear a far-carrying kluut call. Kluut is the name the Dutch have given them. We know them as avocets, birds that went extinct in England because their preferred habitat, brackish lagoons on the volatile Suffolk coast, were disappearing. They were gone for more than a century. War is often good for birds. When humans are more concerned with killing each other than anything else, we get distracted from our normal patterns of destruction. And so during World War II, the Suffolk coast was allowed to flood to make it harder for the Germans to invade, Suffolk being an easy commute from occupied Holland. But it wasn't the Germans that invaded, it was the avocets. Once Suffolk had wild lagoons again, the avocets came back and started breeding again. In 1947, there were already four breeding pairs at Minsmere, a little north of Aldborough, and four or five more on Havergat Island, just south. Now, the cries of the avocet ring out in their hundreds over Suffolk again. They are part of the place once more, a living, cluting proof that conservation works. That if you get a place right, and the birds, being mobile, will fly over, check it out, and move in. Because of this triumph, the avocets, black and white birds with a turny-uppy bill, have become the logo of the RSPB. So, it's a warm day in early spring. You hear a wild screaming as you walk through the reeds. Raise your eyes to the skies for one of the great treats of British birding, the sky dance of the marsh harrier. Birds of prey, reed bed specialists with long wings carried in a shallow V. In spring, they take to the air to perform their gavotte of vernal passion. The male will demonstrate his effectiveness as a provider by passing a chunk of food, a delicious dead water vole or moorhen, to the female. And the female will roll on her back and take the tumbling morsel in mid-air, each bird screaming delight at the other's and its own virtuosity. This was a sound that was almost silence. Perhaps Crabbe heard it. I doubt if Britain did. Marsh harriers went extinct as a breeding species in the 19th century, shot to buggery. They came back to Suffolk between the wars, but habitat loss, persecution by shooting people, an old story, and the reckless use of insecticides brought them back to the edge. The poisons they inadvertently digested caused their eggshells to become thin and the eggs to be unviable. This was when Rachel Carson's world-changing work Silent Spring was published, and we were just beginning to be aware of what we're doing to the planet we live on. In 1971, there was just a single breeding pair in this country, at Minsmere in Suffolk, where else? Since then, conservation organisations have improved the Suffolk coast, creating new reed beds, making the place more like it was always supposed to be. As a result, marsh harriers are thriving. They are now birds you see on a daily basis, gloriously. They are no longer a glorious surprise. And as the climate changes, so some of them have given up migrating to Africa and hang around Suffolk all winter. Certainly, neither Britain nor Crab will have heard the Chetty's warbler. There weren't any to hear. They've turned up in numbers over the course of the last decade or so, global warming birds. They're small brown birds, not much to look at, but prone to explosive bursts of song almost all year. In the wet places of Suffolk, the Chetty's are almost humorously omnipresent, and it seems to be their ambition, like those addicted to sudden prayer, to make God jump. Restoration work has also affected the Sandling Heaths. These places are now better managed, thinned of their trees, not without help from the gale of 1987, many of the exotic conifers removed by other means, and kept open by the grazing of sheep, cattle, and sometimes by ponies. I've had the pleasure of releasing ponies for the Suffolk Wildlife Trust, and it felt as if I was sending them out into heaven. As a result of these inspired pieces of management, you can now hear one of the sweetest of all songs, the yodeling of the woodlark. It sings the first part of its scientific name, which is Lulula arborea. The French call it l'alouette lulu, and Olivier Messiaen captures it wonderfully well in his Catalogue d'oiseaux. Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote a woodlark poem. Tivo, chivo, chivio, chi. Oh, where, what can that be? It's one of the great bad birdwatcher poems. Nor does the music stop at night. I remember another great concert, which I listened to in the company of John Burton of the World Land Trust, who was taking a break from saving the rainforests. He came across a great nocturnal quintet, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, with the voices of nightingale, nightjar, bittern and stone curlew, joined by the rasping cries of natterjack toad. Each voice a triumph for conservation. The coast of Suffolk is a special place, and it's been made more special. Since the war, it has become wilder, richer, noisier. It is, if you like, more like Suffolk than it has been for years. It's become a pilgrimage spot for those who love to look and to listen to Suffolk and to the wild world. Minsmere Bird Reserve was once kept sacred, shut up and apart from the world when the avocets first started to breed there, maximum of 30 visitors a week. Now these precious birds can almost be taken for granted, and visitors come in their thousands and listen to bitterns and nightingales and clutes. Not so many willow warblers, though. These birds were once ubiquitous in Suffolk. Every lane, every thicket was full of that sweet, lisping descent down the scale. Not so many cuckoos, either. Cuckoos were once ordinary birds, birds that turned up everywhere. Less than 20 years ago, it was nothing to hear one within the ring of the M25. Now to hear a willow warbler is a relief. To hear a cuckoo is an event. We've taken ordinary birds, made them special birds, and that's a disastrous way to carry on. But the ringing soundscape of Suffolk also tells us that we can, when we have the will, go through the reverse process and make special birds into ordinary birds, ambient birds, birds that are what they should be, part of the landscape. We become very good at looking after special places. It's the ordinary places we let go to pot. Suffolk Coast is a network of reserves involving organisations that were once almost rivals. RSPB, Suffolk Wildlife Trust, National Trust, Forestry Commission, English nature. It was an early example of landscape-scale conservation, now rightly regarded as the way forward for wildlife conservation in this country. We look on the music of Britain as a national and a global treasure, something that enriches us all and is available to all. The music of the Suffolk coast is every bit as much of a treasure, or, dare I say this on Radio 3, a still greater one. Greater because it lives, greater because it's so fragile, greater because it is, like the Suffolk coast, forever changing, forever renewing. Each bird sings the song of life, which is the song of itself. When you watch a bird sing, you can see that it puts everything it's got into every song, quivering till you think it might explode. It means more than any human music ever can, because to every performer, every song means everything. It's not about life. It is life.
Simon Barnes on the Suffolk soundscape that was such an influence on Britain's work. The producer was Justine Willett. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. From me, Martin Handley, where the Suffolk coast is a crucial protagonist in Britain's opera Peter Grimes, being performed in tonight's BBC Prom, live of course here on Radio 3, by English National Opera, led by their music director Edward Gardner. If compassion for Peter Grimes and Ellen Orford is at the heart of this score, then so too is a portrait of the unsympathetic, sometimes vicious folk of the borough.
Well, it's Britain's great achievement, isn't it, in his operas, that he won't pin anything down for you particularly clearly. And there's morality there, but there's also a horrendous mob and that sheep mentality that can be turned so easily to evil. And then there's this deeply complex, uncomfortable character at the centre of the opera. I mean, that's why the story's so intoxicating. You can't resolve what's right and wrong in it, and all Britain's operas have that element, and they're wonderful to explore for that reason.
Edward Gardner, as the promenaders tell us exactly what vast amounts of money they've collected. Fabulous as always. Well, the orchestral interlude that opens Act 3 describes the profound tranquility of the summer night, but the jabbing phrases on flute and harp suggest the agony in Grimes's head and his inescapable predicament. It's a few days later and a village dance is in full swing in the Moot Hall, just across the road from the Boar pub. The people of the borough are completely transformed from the pious congregation of Act 2. Now they seem drunken and debauched as the nieces try to escape the attentions of Swallow. Mrs. Sedley tells Ned Keane she believes the disappearance of Grimes' apprentice to be murder. He dismisses her theory, but she then overhears Bulstrode saying to Ellen that Grimes' boat is back and there's no sign of him or the boy. Ellen shows Bulstrode the boy's sweater, which he's found down on the shoreline. They decide to help Grimes as best they can. Mrs. Sedley tells Swallow of her suspicions. The crowd gathers to hunt Peter down, their excitement evinced in ever more frenzied cries of Peter Grimes. The final interlude depicts the despair of the half-demented Grimes, symbolised by the dense mist which has blown in from the sea, enveloping everything, and the mournful foghorn which accompanies it. Grimes is alone by his boat on the shore. In the distance are the sounds of the foghorn and the mob. The orchestra silent, his thoughts roam disconnectedly over the events of the past months. Memories besiege him. Every once in a while, his mind returns to the thought of home. He seems utterly lost, and his endless repeating of his name feels as if he's emptying himself. Ellen and Bulstrode approach him, and the captain tells Grimes to take his boat out of sight of land and sink it. Bulstrode helps Peter push the boat down to the water before Ellen and Bulstrode walk slowly away. Dawn breaks and the everyday life of the community resumes. Swallow mentions a report of a boat sinking far out at sea. Just one of those rumours, says Auntie, before the chorus has the final word, singing of the endless motion of the work's other protagonist, the sea. So now, joining his orchestra and chorus on stage here in the Albert Hall, once again, ENO Music Director Edward Gardner. Act 3 of Peter Grimes.